May it please the court, my name is Paul Farooz. I'm representing the appellant, Martin Poggles, who's here today. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. If the trial court is affirmed in this case, this court will be making new law on two distinct arenas. And those arenas are the priority of a purchase money lender as opposed to any other creditor with interest in the same collateral, and the creation of fiduciary duties when there's no legal fiduciary relationship. I'd like to talk about each of those two in turn.
Let me ask you, if in fact there is a fiduciary duty, and I realize that's contested, wouldn't that trump the purchase money security interest?
I don't see any law to support that contention. If there were, and again, you're correct, Your Honor, it's a contested issue of fact, should be remanded to be resolved at trial. If there were a fiduciary duty, I don't see any law supporting the idea that a fiduciary would have to then change the legal order of priority of repayment of debts. There is no law saying that a fiduciary duty upends the laws of creditor-debtor relationships and the order of priority of creditors. So, looking at the purchase money priority issue, there's no dispute in this case that Mr. Poggles sold one half of his commercial real estate to his business partners in exchange for a note secured by a deed of trust on that same property. There's no dispute that in the party's divorce several years later, Ms. Shugraf was awarded cash, Mr. Poggle was awarded his one-half interest in that commercial real estate, together with the debt that the partners owed him under the note for their purchase of that property. So it's undisputed that Mr. Poggle had a purchase money security interest. He was a purchase money lender to the partners. It's undisputed that California law applies to real property situated in California, and that under California law, a purchase money deed of trust takes first priority over all other creditors, even if that purchase money deed of trust is unrecorded. And importantly, respondent cites no case in which a purchase money deed of trust was defeated by any other creditor.
But he didn't foreclose on that deed of trust.
There's no requirement that a purchase money lender must foreclose in order to keep that purchase money priority. And respectfully, I don't think respondent brings forward any law that shows that foreclosure is necessary. If that were the case, you would have no bank able to accept a deed in lieu of foreclosure in order to keep their first priority, right? No bank would be able to accept a deed in lieu of foreclosure. Every creditor would have to go through foreclosure proceedings to be able to protect their purchase money interest, and there's no law holding that that's the case. The cases that respondent cited don't stand for that proposition. I can discuss those cases if you'd like. But I would focus now on saying that the respondent tries to focus this argument on a set of disputed facts talking about what occurred between the creation of the purchase money security interest and the sale of the collateral property more than a decade later. There's no argument here that any of those disputed facts would change the legal order of priority of the purchase money lender, Mr. Poggle. If the facts of what happened in those intervening years matter to the disposition of this case, the case should be remanded so that the facts can be more fully developed at trial. But this court, reviewing de novo, can and should find, as a matter of law, that since Mr. Poggle, as a purchase money lender, had first priority as against any other creditor with an interest in the property, and since the proceeds of the collateral sale were insufficient to repay the first priority debt, let alone junior creditors, the case should be dismissed. To hold otherwise would be to upend California law relating to the priority of purchase money lenders as against other creditors, and following established California law on this point disposes of the whole case. because what we're arguing about is who should have been paid first from the partner share of the collateral property. That share yielded about $300,000. It's undisputed that Mr. Poggle was owed more than $600,000 under the purchase money note. Even if the trust had been a secured creditor of record, it always had a junior interest to the purchase money debt, and satisfying the purchase money lender left nothing else with which to repay the junior creditors. Turning to the question of creation of fiduciary duties, the trial court found that Mr. Poggle owed a fiduciary duty to the trust under the separate or under the property settlement agreement entered into as part of the divorce and under the participation agreement used to share the company's debt between Mr. Poggle and the trust, despite the fact that neither of those documents create a legal fiduciary relationship between Mr. Poggle and the trust. A legal fiduciary relationship being, for example, that between an attorney and a client, a doctor and a patient, a trustee and a beneficiary. There's no such relationship here between Mr. Poggle and the trust. We're talking about an
Isn't the relationship, though, between the father and the daughter?
There is no case holding that every father holds a fiduciary duty to his daughter, and I think actually the relationship that we're looking at, the relationship that respondent directs our attention to, is that between Mr. Poggle and the trust. Now, the trust is an express trust. It's an entity that exists, has a governing document, it has a taxpayer identification number, and it has its own legal fiduciary, the trustee, Ms. Shugraf, at all times. Ms. Shugraf is the one with the legal authority to take action on behalf of the trust, and she did, in fact, take action on behalf of the trust. So the relationship in question, if it's between Mr. Poggle and the trust, which is what respondent alleges, would be the relationship between Mr. Poggle and Ms. Shugraf, the legal, you know, legally authorized person to act on behalf of the trust.
Does the fiduciary determination matter if we disagree with you on the priority of the California deed of trust? Because there's clear evidence of a breach of those contracts. In the failure to follow those terms, and there's attorney fee provisions in those agreements, how would the outcome be different?
Well, there are a series of questions there, Your Honor, and first I would disagree that there's a clear breach of contract.
Well, no, humor me.
Okay, but...
Doesn't the fiduciary issue go away if we simply disagree with you about the nature of the funds that were in his hands? Whether he was entitled to priority or the trust was entitled to them as the proceeds of the business debt?
If the court decides that the trust was entitled, I think you're right that the order of priority of debts is really the dispositive issue here, right?
Because in either way, the money was owed to, if the money was owed to Isabel, then it wasn't paid on time and there was a breach of contract and it was a timely action under the six-year statute, and the attorney fees would be triggered under the ordinance. So it turns on the California issue.
I think it does turn on the issue of priority, but again, there's a series of
In 10 minutes, you can give us your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jason Burnett for the respondent, Susie Shugraf.
Let's start in the same place because there's all the briefing about who's a fiduciary and which statute of limitations applies, and doesn't all of that go away once you determine whether these funds were entitled to be treated as the proceeds of a first deed of trust or whether they were not and they were treated as a business debt that was subject to the contracts?
I don't think that squarely decides it, and this is why. The first reason that doesn't squarely decide it is because whether Mr. Poggle had a purchase money security interest or not, he did not enforce that security interest when the property was sold to a third party in an arm's length transaction. If you look at the settlement statement, the closing statement, it shows the encumbrances on title that were paid off through escrow, including the Lantern financing deed of trust, that's appropriate, including utilities, taxes, charges, all kinds of proration. That's what happens when a security interest is sold. When the security interest is sold, the property, everyone steps up and they say, I've got an interest in that. Pay me from closing. That's how people get their money. That's not what happened here. What happened here was Mr. Poggle never disclosed that the interest to the escrow company. He sold the property. kept half of the proceeds, as was his right, and then the other half of the proceeds he proceeded to dissemble about for roughly, well, since 2012, so 5 years. He told a variety of different stories about what happened to that money.
All right, but
none of
my question was that money that's in dispute in this case. If we agree with you that it was the proceeds of the business debt and not the foreclosure of his interest, don't the other issues go away?
I believe that
yes
they do.
Or no question.
I believe that they do. I apologize for misunderstanding the court's question. I do believe that that does
right,
resolve.
So then focus on the other one.
Okay. So, you know, as to the issue of a fiduciary duty, it's clear that Mr. Poggle stood in between the debt.
Okay, well, now I got to come back to you and say, why does it matter if you talk to me about the fiduciary duty if the issue that's dispositive of this whole thing is what was the nature of the funds that he received? Because whether he was a fiduciary or he simply breached the agreements, doesn't that determine whether she's entitled to the funds and whether she's entitled to attorney's fees in these proceedings?
I believe it does. I think the reason I was focusing on fiduciary duty is because that's how I've framed this entire case up until about 5 minutes ago. On the fly, I can think real quick and skip over the fiduciary thing and just
Well, you better persuade us about the California issue or you might be on the wrong end of the
decision. Okay. Well, you know, under California law, if you look at the case that, you know, we keep citing, this Moeller case, what it involved was it involved a purchase money security interest that was enforced at closing. It was not enforced after closing against funds that belonged to a third party. That is the key elemental distinction. Security interests are satisfied out of closing. They're not satisfied later, years later, after the property's been conveyed.
Well, what's your response to counsel's assertion that that would preclude lenders from taking deeds in lieu of foreclosure?
Well, that's not what he did. He didn't take a deed in lieu of foreclosure.
No, that's not what he did, but nobody said he did. My question was, what's your response to counsel's assertion that your analysis of how this fits together would preclude people from lenders from taking
it? It's an absolute red herring. If Mr. Poggle had taken a deed in lieu of foreclosure,
is it true?
Then maybe, but it's.
I don't care whether he did or not.
Okay.
Okay. You understand where we are here, right?
Oh, okay.
We've got your case, and then we worry about the six cases that come later.
Okay.
Right. So, is it so that what he said is true, that your construction would disincentivize lenders from taking deeds in lieu of foreclosure in California?
No, absolutely not.
And why not?
Well, for the first and most obvious reason is that whatever Washington says about California law doesn't control anything in California. So that's the first reason. Whatever this court
disincentivize lenders. If you're a lawyer for a lender, You would look at your client and say, you know, there's this Washington Court of Appeals case that purports to construe California law. It's not binding on anybody, so don't worry about it. Just go ahead.
Well, I will tell you what banks do. Banks include non-merger language in every deed of lieu accepted in lieu of foreclosure. Every deed accepted in lieu of foreclosure includes non-merger language. And that's been the case since the shakeout from 2008 or 2009. It's not going to disincentivize anyone because this issue has long been litigated and banks have long addressed it by including anti-merger language in all of their contracts. That's been the law for years now.
Well, that's not the law. That's
well, I apologize for that. It's been the pattern and practice of all banks, all national banks, all local banks. It's that's just how it works. It's not going to disincentivize anybody. Now, you know, as far as the argument that this was analogous to a deed in lieu of foreclosure, I think it's important to recognize that that is the very last argument that has been raised by Mr. Poggle's lawyers, and it's entirely inconsistent with Mr. Poggle's own declarations because he's given us at least four different stories about what happened. Mr. Poggle said that the property was sold and the kid's money was sitting in trust. That's at CP 192, and he said that in 2012. In 2013, he said that $238,900 of that money went to pay the Anna Robin loan principal. That was untrue. The Anna Robin loan principal was $212,500. He also said there was $68,000 for the children's trust. But if you look at the CP 141-142, the PMSI doesn't show up on that closing statement. And then in 2016, Mr. Poggle testified the Children's Trust got nothing. And then he blamed it on Ms. Shugraf. And then in 2016, he also said that he foreclosed on the business debt and collected the property used as collateral to secure the debt. And that was not true. He didn't foreclose the debt. He didn't foreclose the business debt. He didn't foreclose the PMSI debt. And that was on CP 492 that he said that. And then 2017, Mr. Padua gave another story where he said he recovered what he could on the business debt, the $1.2 million debt, by taking title to their half of the property, and that they so personally owed him for the $212,500 they promised to pay him. Now, this is where the fiduciary duty becomes, I think, relevant.
But because these all sound like credibility issues, and this was resolved on summary judgment, though. How does that all matter?
Well, it's not a credibility issue. The court didn't make a credibility determination. It's a weight issue. The court never said she didn't believe Mr. Poggle. But if a party steps up and offers six different explanations for one occurrence, the court is entitled to give those declarations an exceedingly small amount of weight. Now, Mr. Poggle cannot create issues of fact by arguing with himself or with his own lawyers.
Why can the court do that on summary judgment?
Pardon me?
Why can the court do that on summary judgment?
Why can the court accord very little weight?
Yeah, it's summary judgment. We construe things in favor of the non-moving party.
Absolutely. So then,
the trial court does the same thing.
Well, the question becomes, which thing are you going to construe in his favor? His statement from 2012, the one from 2013, the one from 2016, or the one from 2017? Because they're inconsistent with each other. They're mutually inconsistent. He says he foreclosed. That wasn't true. He didn't foreclose.
You seem to be describing some sort of fact-finding going on.
Pardon me?
You seem to be describing some sort of fact-finding going on.
Well, these are the facts in the record that have not been contested. I mean, the settlement statement is in the record. Mr. Poggle provided it via email to his wife, where he said, attached to the 7th Street seller statement. So we've used that statement.
Can I ask you real quickly, as we're running out of time, about the fiduciary duty? Is it a legal or a factual fiduciary duty, and to whom is the duty owed here?
It is both a legal and a factual fiduciary duty, and the duty is owed to the beneficiaries of the trust.
Meaning his daughter.
Pardon me?
Meaning his daughter?
Meaning his daughter. In this case, there's also a trust for Max.
Not to the trust itself, as opposed to the daughter. If there is a difference there, that's why I'm asking.
I that's an interesting question. I don't think that there's a difference. I think, but I think that the duty is owed to the beneficiaries of the trust. The trust is just an artificial creation. And there's a trustee, but in this case, Mr. Poggle, everyone had to rely on Mr. Poggle to collect the money on the business debt and then distribute it out according to everybody's respective percentages. Nobody else could collect on that business debt. Mr. Poggle was the only one. And that is the essence of a fiduciary, is a person who's standing in the middle, collects stuff that is for his benefit and maybe other people's benefit, and then parcels it out. That's like an escrow company. It's what an escrow company does. That's exactly what Mr. Poggle's role was here. And then Mr. Poggle, in that role, engaged in self-dealing. The $212,000 debt was money that he loaned to them, and they sent a promissory note back to him. So it was never real cash in the first place. That's why it was a breach of fiduciary duty. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
I want to point out a couple of things. First, there's no dispute that for as long as the company was repaying its debt, Mr. Poggle repaid everybody as he was supposed to. The dispute starts when the company fails. And I'm addressing Judge Applewick's feeling that there was a breach of contract here, and I assume that that's because you're worried about lack of notice. And the record shows that Mr. Poggle gave Ms. Shugraf notice for years that the company was failing. But I'll move on to...
No, that wasn't my focus. My focus was that the payment obligation was that within 10 days of receipt of monies that were payable to the trust, he tender those monies. That clearly didn't happen if you agree with their characterization of the funds, so you have a breach of contract and it triggers the results. So I'm just wondering why we have to decide a damn thing about trust or this trust statute of limitations on a tort or anything else.
Fair, Your Honor. And I think that point brings us to the, you know, a single root here, which is we know that the partners transferred the real property to Mr. Poggle in 2012, right? I think there's a dispute about whether that transfer was in satisfaction of the company debt or in satisfaction of the purchase money debt. And if there's a dispute there, and if it's not clear from the record, this case should not have been decided on summary judgment. And I would submit there is an active dispute, and the record is not clear. As to my client's declarations, English is not his first language, and I think the bench was completely correct that these are issues of credibility. These are factual issues. They should have been resolved at trial. And regarding the kind of final discussion of the respondent, I believe what counsel insinuated was that Mr. Poggle became a fiduciary under the participation agreement. By virtue of the relationship that he was holding the debt, administering it for the benefit of himself and all the other creditors. And as we pointed out, there's no Washington law on that point. There's no Washington law that says the relationship that's created under every participation agreement is a fiduciary relationship, right? There's Ninth Circuit guidance. The Ninth Circuit makes it appear that this also is a question of fact. Respondent cites no case saying that a participation agreement or one party administering a debt and sharing that with all the others creates a fiduciary relationship. And the Ninth Circuit says when you don't see language in the participation agreement saying a fiduciary relationship exists, you shouldn't presume that one exists. Here there's no such language. Here there is an appointed fiduciary, Ms. Shugraf, who reviewed the participation agreement with her counsel, made edits, and agreed to enter into it on behalf of the trust. And lastly, I'd like to address the merger issue, which was briefly raised by counsel. I think the question is, when Mr. Poggle took back title to the real property, did that extinguish the partner's debt to him? And I would say that 100 years worth of California case law makes it clear it did not extinguish the partner's debt from him. And to so hold would be to upend that portion of California law regarding merger as well.
Did you brief that issue?
We did brief that issue. It's in our brief. Yes. It
doesn't extinguish their debt.
It does not extinguish their debt. Because when there are intervening liens, the first priority creditor taking back title to the collateral doesn't extinguish that first priority. And again, you can use an analogy that's like a bank foreclosure, a bank. You know,
I thought I understood you to say it didn't extinguish their debt to him.
That's right. It did not extinguish the debt to him. The debt did not merge into title.
The business debt or the purchase money?
The purchase money debt.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. We are in recess.